scribe selection. Oh, sorry, call notes, scribe selection, introductions and reintroductions. And then for the highlight today, we'll talk about a couple of emerging standards in, that are relevant. And this will be the first of sort of an ongoing series, especially as we're kicking off the task force to learn about different efforts in the space that are relevant for verifiable credentials in education. And then lastly, and for that, I've heard a lot of interest in the DID web method. So actually, Dimitri, one of the authors of the spec, has joined us today. Thank you, Dimitri. And he'll be available to answer any questions for us about how it's used and, you know, sort of the goals of it. Then lastly, there were a lot of sort of comments on the task force charter and, you know, about related efforts and things like that. So I thought we could review. One last note is that there's an IMS conference at happening either right now or people are traveling for it, so we may have lighter attendance today. let's see. So, but that's actually fine. These meetings are recorded, so everyone who can't make it today will be able to listen and they'll be very interested in the comment. And Dimitri, yes, actually your DID web related slides will be very good to see. So I'll ping you for a link to those, or that's probably Excellent. The best way if you have a link to it.
Yep, not a problem. So I just pasted you the link on IRC message, but here it is.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Oh, I see it. I see it right there. Yes. Okay. I'll repost that when we get closer to you.
Perfect.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Okay. So that's the agenda for today. So for now, for the boilerplate stuff, IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. To the information about the W3C community contributor license agreement is available here if you want to read about that. But to actually join, if you haven't already, you first have to create a W3C account. Web account. This is very quick and it's free. And also joining the credentials community group is quick and free. This is the two links that you would follow to do that. So the takeaway is that before you make any substantive contributions to this group in any way, whether that's GitHub or on calls, we need you to join. And that's for the protection of all the groups so that we don't get what we're talking about here patented out from under us, which is wonderful about the W3C. Okay, so call notes. These meetings and audio recording of everything said on this call are archived to the following location. I've pasted that in IRC. And we use IRC to cue speakers during the call as well as to take minutes. Let us know if you have any problems getting on IRC. All attendees should type present plus. There's a lot of people doing that right now, so you can see what they're doing in IRC to get your name on the attendee list in the transcript. To add yourself to the queue in IRC, type the letter Q plus, no space in between. And you can write an optional reminder. Let's see, Q plus to the word to mention, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to call in Sophia for a second to talk to the CEPC part. If you're not on IRC, you can simply be asked to be put on the queue. And also, please be brief so the rest of the queue can have a chance to chime in. You can always Q plus again. Lastly, the meeting is held by voice, not IRC. So if you have something interesting you're talking about, try to, you know, not, you can use IRC to talk about it, but Make sure that you're talking about it in voice as well by adding yourself to the queue and bringing it up, because that's the main thread of discussion. Sophia, do you mind if I call on you a second to talk about the link that you added?
Sure. Just as long as Kim's doing the boilerplate, I'll just remind everybody that all meetings, working group, community group, whatever they are, operate under the W3C's Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct. And I dropped a link into IRC.
Thank you very much, Fia. And actually, I'm going to look into adding those to our, it'll be straightforward to add them to our general credentials community group boilerplate. We should do that in general. Okay, the fun part, we need a scribe. So usually we go through a document for CCG folks, but this is, I expect this to have a separate scribe candidate list. So I'm going to go through, and well, first, if there's any volunteers for scribing, please pipe up now. Otherwise, I'll just start walking through the list. And it's really easy. It's a valuable way to contribute when you're getting involved and on an ongoing basis to the group. So for reference, if you joined the call last week, Juan scribed for us, and so he was just sort of typing some things in as we talked. So we try to rotate through scribes so we don't get scribe fatigue. So I'm not going to call on Juan again today. Let's see. Yeah?
Sorry,
I thought I heard someone.
I think just someone coughed.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought it said, gotcha. I thought it sounded like my name. Cool. Thank you, Juan. And thanks again for volunteering last week. Let's see. Who do we have? I see a few people that I do not think are on the call. Oops. Okay, I'm going to start with some people who've been on at least one before. And Jane, sorry to do this to you. Would you mind scribing today?
Sure. I'm not totally sure what to do, but I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you so much. Just for reference, especially while we're getting started, I think there are a bunch of people that are new to this, but as an example, as I'm saying right now, you start with someone's alias, and usually you know that alias because they just added themselves to the queue. So I'm Kim HD, so if I were Jane scribing for me, I'd say Kim HD talks about scribing. I'm going to press enter so that so this would be Jane's typing this, and he would just write the alias colon, a brief summary of what's happening. That's useful to know. One, if there's an alias that's hard to spell or remember, you can type two or three letters and hit tab. I didn't realize that. And then also, if Kim is talking for a long time, I could type dot, 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 keeps talking. Like this, and then that would, that way you can start just getting some things flushed out while you continue to type. But also at the same time, while we're getting started, please feel free to, talk slowly, clearly, and make life easier on the scribe. And James, feel free to, scribe gets the right to interrupt at any time and let people know that they don't understand a word or need clarification, things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Is there an easy way? Is there an easy way to see the aliases? List out all the aliases.
They are, if you are in the web IRC, they're kept to the right-hand side. Do you see that? It starts with Alan Davies. Yeah.
I think most clients, you can type /names as well.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and if Safari doesn't show the names panel.
Try the other way. Sorry, what was that?
I was going to say, if Safari doesn't show the names panel, try opening it up in Chrome.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. Okay. Let me see, I misspelled something here. Okay, topic, introductions, reintroductions. Okay, so we did a lot of introductions last week. And so I think still while we're getting started with the group, I want to, make sure people are able to introduce themselves, so get to learn about each other's experience and background. Does anyone want to volunteer to reintroduce themselves? Either you weren't on the call the first time or didn't do it last time.
Hi,
go ahead.
Am I on call? Yeah, hi, my name is David Mason. My name is David Mason, and I'm working in a group called Talent Cloud in the Government of Canada. And that's it.
Great. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, James, that was David M., I think. Okay, great. Yeah. Excellent. Okay, and next we have David. Is this David Chadwick on the queue?
Yeah, just to introduce myself again, because I've not been on this list, actually. Just so people know, I've been an active member of the VC Working Group and actively contributed to the standard and to the implementation guidelines. And for the last 6 months, we've been working on our implementation, which is now sort of ready. And so I've got time to start participating in the groups again. But it's been really hectic the last 6 months.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here, someone with such background and expertise in it. While we're struggling to figure out how to use verifiable credentials for education, so thank you for joining. Carrie, you're up.
Hello. I thought I would introduce myself to you. My name is Carrie Lemoy. I've been working in Open Badges for a long time, mostly on the Open Badges standard. So I'm a technologist, but I'm actually working in this capacity as more of a technology researcher. So I'm here to learn, and I will contribute and help as much as I can.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. And for those who aren't familiar with her already, she does have a lot of experience in Open Badges. And so I think, there's a lot of work happening to align Open Badges with verifiable credentials. And so I think a lot of people joining these calls are interested in that specifically. Let's see what we have next. Okay, so I think that's a good amount for introductions and reintroductions. For the highlight of today, I wanted to sort of give some context around that. So, 1 second while I do some maintenance. Okay, so I think that in general, as we move forward, we're going to be talking more about, sort of work items like doing things, maybe working on a draft of data standards, things like that. For whether it's representing open badges as verifiable credentials, working through examples of, say, verifiable credentials with credential engine registry, sort of taxonomies, things like that. But as we're getting started, I think a lot of people from the education space are sort of new to verifiable credentials, W3C, and related decentralized identity world kinds of standards. So early on, to help get everyone on the same page and using the same terminology, hopefully, we'll start reviewing some emerging standards. Today, we'll focus on some that are coming out of the credentials community group, but other ones that we'll do in the future could include examples from Decentralized Identity Foundation, or DIF. We're also interested in having more, sort of like implementation focus groups. So whether that's Broward group, or, even someone to present about things like European initiatives, European SSI framework, things like that, and how that would fit in. So I think this group has had an advantage that it's drawn a group outside of what the credentials community group normally gets, so we can have kind of more focused discussions and hopefully understand these different efforts and how they might fit together to support the use cases we're talking about. So I included the link to the slide deck that I to queue up this section. So just click on that link if you can. It was also included in the meeting in the agenda that was sent out. So go to the second slide. And as I was saying just now, this is the first of an ongoing series discussing relevant emerging standards. And today we'll talk about some emerging credentials community group standards that I think are especially relevant to this group. DIDWeb, I'll tee up Dimitri and then call on him because he has some slides. We'll talk about that, and then I briefly want to talk about some credential issuer and credential verifier APIs. I noticed a lot of people working on building their sets of APIs. I figure it could save a lot of time if you know there's another group of people working on it and working on standardizing it. And so, if you know of related efforts, it would be good for us to kind of compare notes and things like that. Going forward, if there are any kinds of topics that you want to hear about relevant to this space, just let us know and we'll try to get people invited. And in fact, a lot of people in the call right now are people that we would like to call on at some point to talk more about their area. So for example, Greg Nadeau to talk about what they're doing in Broward, anything about the European SSI framework or EDCI, I don't remember what that stands for at the moment, but there's a lot of interesting, relevant efforts that we'd like to understand. So to tee up Dimitri, the DIDWeb method. So go on to slide 3, and I'm gonna do a super, super quick intro to decentralized identifiers. I think most people on the call I've talked to about before, but just to attempt to get on the same page and understand what purpose they serve, I want to talk about where they fit in a verifiable credential. So decentralized identifiers are a string, and specifically, if it means anything to you, a URI, from which a DID document can be resolved. And that DID document can contain things like signing keys, ways to support authentication, and just generally secure means of interacting with some party. So if you want to get more into decentralized identifiers, reach out to me after the call and we can do a separate deep dive on that. We're sort of trying to find the right balance of technical level of detail in this call. But the main things I wanted to call out for purposes of this call are, if you look to the right side of the slide, there's an example of a verifiable credential, a very small example. There's a rectangle, a blue rectangle, but it's under the issuer part that says issuer ID, and then you see the string, did, colon, example, colon, a bunch of characters. And then also in the credential subject ID field, you see did, colon, example, colon, a bunch of characters. So that's an example of what a did looks like. And the analogy, a way to start describe the purpose of it, so for the issuer, this string can be resolved to a did document so that a verifier can confirm the keys that sign this credential are indeed the keys that you would expect for that issuer. On the credential subject side, that ID can be used to, if you take that did example, EB, et cetera, resolve it to a did document, then that can say, okay, the subject of this credential, I expect to be able to cryptographically prove ownership of a key associated with their did, for example. So the analogies in open badges world is for the issuer, it's a lot like an issuer profile. So the issuer profile in open badges, it's like a URL typically, like a web page. There's JSON at it, and it says, here's some information about the issuer. On the learner side or credential subject side, that's like an email. So typically in open badges, the subject has been identified by an email or a hash of an email historically, but actually very soon, and I think Open Badges 2.1, they'll be supporting DIDs as well. So that's very exciting news. And Gabe from Workday and Nate Otto from Concentric Sky are working on that. So so quickly going to slide four, I had some notes here. The quick thing I want to say, then I'll turn over to Dimitri, is that it's a did method that can be used to bootstrap using an existing web domain's reputation. I won't go into any other details here in favor of walking through Dimitri's slides, but effectively, a lot of did methods that you may have heard people talk about, they use blockchains and things like that. Did web is interesting to a lot of people who are looking to use DIDs in verifiable credentials right now because it's there. It's easy to do. You don't have to worry about the whole blockchain that it's based on. So I'm going to turn over to Dimitri and post his slides in there so he can talk us through that. So thank you so much, Dimitri, for joining us, and I'll turn over to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Kim. So my name is Dimitri Zagadulin. I'm a software engineer in the field of personalized data storage, decentralized identity, and verifiable credentials. I'm one of the authors of the DID web method spec, along with Oliver Terabu from Consensus and Amy Guy. So let's see. Excellent. Yeah. So in the interest of saving time, and because Kim has already went over the general purpose behind DIDs, I'm going to skip over some of the slides. But what I want to get across today is, why did we come up with the DID method? Where does it fit in the DID ecosystem? How is it useful for verifiable credentials? And what are some of the challenges and benefits of using it? All right, so jump to slide four. I think everybody on this call is likely familiar with both DIDs and credentials already, but I just want to reiterate. So why do we need identifiers in general? Like, what problems do DIDs solve? They're super useful in any sort of credentials, a special educational credential that we want to do for two reasons. To uniquely identify the issuer, and to uniquely identify the entity being issued to. Identify both in the sense of disambiguate, right? So, for example, which is why regular human names don't really work well as globally unique identifiers. There's a lot of ambiguity, but also identify in the sense of provide a unique identifier that could be reusable elsewhere. So go on to slide 5. When presenting decentralized identifiers to many, even technical audiences, one of the first questions that gets asked is, well, isn't this problem already solved? Why can't we use, and this is straight up, people have asked this, why can't we use social security numbers, right? So reason this is hard, the reason where we're working with DIDs and specifically DIDWeb in general is, for the most part, government entities actually do not want to be responsible for managing the identifiers themselves. So the Social Security Administration greatly regrets all of its life choices and does not want, like, it is currently very much fighting an education battle to say to people, don't, like, this is not what we use the number for. We don't want to manage a unique United States citizen number. I mean, aside from the fact that the namespace is very small, you can't account for all citizens and so on. So in addition to somebody has to go through considerable administrative effort of managing them, the difficult part is usually how do you prove control of the identifier? Now, in person with like a physical passport or a driver's license, it's a little bit easier because there tend to be very few issuers, nation states, and they use a combination of biometrics and then simple proof of possession. Like if you're holding the passport in your hand, that there's a, like, you are literally proving control over the identifier. Obviously, in all sorts of online use cases, that's much harder. So let's briefly touch on slide 6. And then we're going to skip over the history of identifiers on the internet, like how did DIDs evolve. So what we're looking for is something that is collision resistant and globally unique, portable, by which I mean if my identifier was issued in one organization, I can, when I leave it, I can still reuse my identifier, or alternatively, that I can bring your own, that I can use my existing identifiers in new contexts. And we want our identifier technology to be able to prove control over. And obviously, if at all possible, we also want it to be resolvable. In addition just to the bare identifier string, we want to be able to resolve and find out more about the entity. All right, so we're gonna skip to slide 12 and 13. We're familiar with what DIDs look like. Slide 14 just reminds us that DIDs specifically resolve to machine-readable documents that basically have two main sections, key material and links to services. But notice that, and this is by design, what they do not have is any sort of personally identifiable information that could be useful for identity proofing. That's intended to be handled by the services themselves. All right, so let's skip to slide 16. So at the moment, and there's over 50 DID methods in the unofficial DID registry currently. At the moment, you can think of all of the DID methods as divided into four general categories. There are ephemeral DIDs that are not globally resolvable. that are useful in either temporary, ephemeral, or very local contexts, such as DigKey. There's some DidCom-based methods that Decentralized Identity Foundation is working on. So they're a good tool in a very particular use case. There's, of course, DidWeb that we're talking about today. There's a number of distributed hash tables, which you can think of as sort of a hybrid or transitional technology between web and ledgers. So IPFS is an example of a distributed hash table. Blockstack uses a combination of hash table and cryptocurrency ledgers to anchor their identifiers. And of course, we have the blockchains that we know and love, which get divided into three rough categories. There's the cryptocurrency-based ones, like Bitcoin and Ethereum. There is non-coin-based ones that just store credential digits, like Sovereign, / Hyperledger Indy, like Verus One, and many others. And then there's, of course, ledgers that are deployed within a particular enterprise or within a particular domain. And those are the private permissioned ledgers, the leading example of which is currently Hyperledger Fabric. So jumping to slide 17, DIDs make great identifiers, especially for verifiable credentials. They have good properties that we're looking for in identifiers. They're standardized. Great. Okay. So where does DidWeb come in? So let's jump to slide number 19. So anybody actually deploying or doing proof of concept or pilot using this new DID technology runs into several common challenges. One, everybody quickly discovers that key management is hard and building walls is hard. But that's outside the scope of this talk. Everybody has that problem. Every single DID method has the same requirement of, we better figure out how to manage our private keys. Okay. Each DID method needs to provide tooling, as simple as they need a client or a resolver plugin to be able to resolve the DID, get the DID document back, as well as manage keys and interact with the ledger or registry in some way. And preferably, the challenge is we need those clients. Hold on one sec, my dog has just arrived. Kick her out. Okay, so we need. So each new DID method would ideally have to provide clients that work on the server, but also preferably in the browser and also on mobile apps, since those are sort of the three major ecosystems that the clients will have to deal with. Obviously, DID methods differ in the throughput of read and write operations that are available, right? So some, like Bitcoin, are very slow, only a handful of transactions a second, and some are very fast. But obviously, the Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies have other good properties that make up for the slow throughput. But the biggest problem that every single implementer, both of DID methods or just a dev team trying to do something with it, immediately runs into is identity proofing, especially identity proofing of the issuers. Organizational identity is an extremely hard problem. You can think of it as, how do I know that this gobbledygook DID identifier actually belongs to some trusted entity? How do I know that this DID belongs to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, to the U.S. government, to a particular university, and so on? And this is a hard problem. And it gets harder and easier depending on use cases. So, for example, in some industries, like medical schools, they are tightly regulated, the identifiers are known, and you can reuse at least mappings of existing identifiers to DIDs. But in others, like universities and colleges and schools in general, it's still a very difficult problem. So jumping to the slide 20, the idea for Dead Web arose out of the need to mostly to solve the problem of trust anchors, of saying, okay, this is a hard problem, to some extent, obviously not fully, so it's not an ideal system. Existing domains have solved this. They've done identity proofing, especially in the top-level domains of education and government, right? The .edu and .gov. So wouldn't it be interesting, wouldn't it be helpful to reuse some of that technical and social infrastructure? Wouldn't it be great to reuse the fact that Harvard.edu is a known and trusted brand, and can we use that to bootstrap their identity in various other ledgers, or use it to sign credentials directly? It also has the benefit of the working with web documents is very familiar technology to developers. Though it's very important to note that the web and the legacy technology does bring with itself some risks and drawbacks, which is very important to be aware of and to mitigate with complementary technologies to Dead Web. So real briefly, in slide 21, what does the Dead Web actually look like? Well, so the DID method identifier is DID colon web, and then the fully qualified domain name minus the protocol. At the moment, the protocol of HTTPS is required by the methods, though whether or not to allow different protocols going forward, different web protocols, is an item under discussion. But basically, you take a URL, you stick the web in front of it, and you have a DID. It looks like the document that you get back when doing an HTTP GET on that URL looks like any other DID document. It has a DID, it has public key material, and links to other service endpoints to do any sort of discovery. Okay, great. So how do we, in addition to cryptographically proving that I have the private key, how do I actually bind a DID to an existing domain? And there's two methods used here. You can either upload it to a well-known location at the top level of the domain, or alternatively, there's another proposed mechanism. You can use a field in the DNS record to point to the location of the DID, and provided a link to the RFC in the slides. So, and those are two very common mechanisms used in other fields to prove ownership of a domain. Either you upload a file to a well-known place, or you prove that you can have control over the DNS records associated with that domain. So slide 23, we already touched on some of the benefits of what do you get if you use your pilot or proof of concept on DID Web. You get to reuse a lot of the existing infrastructure and knowledge. Most importantly, and this tends to come up a lot, especially in the education use case, brands that have invested a lot of resources into building trust in their web domain names can reuse that investment. It's fairly fast and easy to deploy, and most importantly, it serves as, I mean, to put it bluntly, we have 50 different DID methods. I think many dev teams are waiting to see how this shakes out, which ones get adoption, which ones come out ahead. So DID Web provides sort of an intermediate or a bridge step while we wait to see which distributed ledger technology, or which several emerge, so they can serve as a stepping stone to either distributed hash tables or blockchains. Like we mentioned, a lot of the discussion around DID webs, especially when it was when it came time for them to be adopted as an official working item of the Credential Community Group, resolves around very real challenges and fears about the existing web infrastructure. For example, if I host a DID document on a particular domain, especially if it's a domain that is lent to me, for example, I'm a student and I'm using my university's website to host my my personal DID. Let's say I have my own subdomain. How do we know that the web host, either the organization or some rogue system administrator, doesn't actually change the contents of the document from under me? With blockchains and with distributed hash tables, you have some of that integrity protection mechanism built in. The blockchain itself provides some guarantee of integrity protection and change history so that you know that if you follow the spec of the method, you are guaranteed that there's the one-to-one binding of DID to a DME document in most cases, which is not the case for traditional web documents. So how do we make sure that the document doesn't change from under us inadvertently or maliciously? So fortunately, there's a complementary standard emerging called hashlinks that you can use in conjunction with DID web to lock down the contents of the website, of the DID document, so that it cannot be changed without breaking the URL itself. And it's essentially, hashlinks do two things. They allow you to specify an existing content hash of a web document, and they also allow you to specify several backup URLs where to find that document. So if that your main website goes down, you can look at any number of other places, and you're still guaranteed that of the integrity of the document due to that hash. Right, so prevent tampering, easy. That bit is solved with hashlinks. What about the general problem with certificate authorities? Well, one, that was one of the initial motivations for developing decentralized identifiers in the first place. People wanted to mitigate some of the problems, such as certificate authorities being either hijacked or being malicious actors in of themselves and essentially messing with which server a URL resolves to. So there's two answers to that. One is, so that's why we have the other ledgers. We're waiting to see how that hashes out. The other thing that I want to remind everybody in a lot of these discussions is that one of the main examples of the certificate authorities being hijacked that comes up with this conversation was essentially over 20 years ago. And the technological powers that be on the web have developed a set of technologies to address this, to prevent certificate authority hijacking from happening, specifically the infrastructure of certificate transparency, which can be summed up as, how do we make sure that a certificate authority doesn't go rogue while everybody watches everybody and records cryptographic snapshots of which domains and which servers certificates belong to? So it's a fairly robust set of technologies. And what's interesting is that the solutions that the distributed ledgers will have to come up with will largely look like certificate transparency, right? It's a fairly basic and fundamental solution dictated by the shape of the problem of, if you have multiple authorities, how do you make sure that one doesn't go rogue? Well, you have watchers, and the watchers sort of watch everybody and write down everything that happens. So what to do about certificate authorities? Well, we'll see what sort of solutions the blockchain world comes up with. And also, the risks are overstated. Now, here we come to the other major challenge slash drawback with DID Web that is still a work in progress, which is if we're using hash links to lock down the contents of the DID document to a particular version, what happens when I want to add a new key to the DID document? What happens when I want to rotate or revoke a key, right? That changes the contents of the DID document. Does that mean my hash link breaks? So it's a very real problem. So there's good news and bad news. Bad news is we're still working on it. The good news is that we're fairly confident that we can come up with a solution because there are already precedents. For example, Keybase, which is, I think, is a proprietary standard, but is an excellent example of a deployed solution to this. So Keybase is one example. IPFS and IPLD, the interplanetary linked data, also solve this problem. And basically, they solve it by a chain of backwards links. You're essentially using the same cryptographic mechanism that blockchains use, except on a particular website. So that starting with a given hash link, you can follow the link of changes to the newest to the newest version of the document. And Sam talks about this in the DID working group and the credential working group in terms of self-certifying identifiers and the blanking out on the name of his paper. But so the exact recommended solution for this is still an in-progress working item. So those are the main points about DID Web. What sort of questions do people have? So to briefly summarize, if you're sitting down and are saying, okay, verifiable credentials are great, let's do some sort of toy code or proof of concept. What are we going to use? Which method are we going to use? That is globally resolvable, has enough cryptographic protections for a beginning use case, but it can also be future-proof, migratable to other ledger technologies. DID Web is a fairly decent one. The mechanism of migration, of binding between DID Web and other ledgers, we haven't gotten into here. That can be a topic of a further further phone call. But essentially, the DID working group is working right now on the ability to reuse the service endpoints to chain DIDs together for purposes of portability and so on. So any questions? Carrie, thank you, Kim.
Sorry
that's
about
what
that.
It is. Yeah. No, that's perfect. Yeah, I was blanking out on the name.
Great. Yeah, we included a bunch of links.
Perfect.
So thank you. This is a wonderful discussion of DID Web, and we do have a queue. One thing I wanted to mention is that I'm going to push the credential issuer verifier discussion to next week because that's small anyway, and this is a great topic. So first on the queue, we have Chris Wink. Chris, are you muted?
Yes. Sorry, Kim. Dimitri, thanks so much. This is really helpful. I have a question on slides 21 and 22.
Okay.
When you're talking about the key material, is this completely separate from the CA root structure of the domain itself?
Excellent question. Yes. So one of the nice things about the DID standard is that it specifies a number of key format and cryptographic suites that you can use that is in addition to the traditional, let's say, RSA-based keys that are found in domain certificates. So yes, this is separate. Now, if you wanted to reuse the public key material in your domain certificate, you could. The DID method and the various cryptographic suites do support the kind of RSA keys that are found in CA. So you could reuse that. But one of the benefits is that you don't have to.
So would that technically be a third option on slide 22, that you could upload a document, you could show control over a DNS record, or you could use key material derived from the CA root for that domain?
Oh, that's a very good point. Either derived from the CA root, or you could, I believe there are additional metadata fields in the certificate that you can use to point to this. So yes, that's actually a great point that I'll bring up to in the DID web sessions. I think everybody has traumatic memories of how certificates are, so we forget that they're also another option. But thank you so much for bringing that up.
Yep. Thank you.
Next, I'll call on Durga.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm working on something along the lines where I'm working with Convergence, a company based in Toronto, and I think we are using a system called Open Attestation that is developed by Singapore government. It has something the same like DNS text verification. Have you looked at this? I think this is something similar to DID Web that you were just talking.
No, but I would like to. That sounds relevant and interesting. If you don't mind, can you post a link to it on IRC?
Yeah, I posted it. They use a text within the DNS data. They see there is available metadata that you can add. And they verify the metadata and verify the domains and they verify the domain location and see its authority and
fantastic.
Look into this. And
yes, so
and they built this over Ethereum also.
Great point. I just want to point out that the item 2 on flight 22 is exactly this mechanism. It also uses the text field of the DNS record to bind to DID. So very, very similar. I would not be surprised if the authors of these two standards are in similar community. So yes, absolutely. Using the text key in DNS record, great solution.
Okay. So now let's say your web address does not have strong authority. How would you recommend us to go ahead with this? Like, let's say we are enrolling new universities or new colleges which do not have a lot of recognition.
That's an excellent question. So, and that's more of a social engineering question than specifically to the DID web method. The first two things that come to mind are partner with an existing consortium or trusted authority. Or use whatever the methods of building trust that are being used by institutions for their domain names today, right? It's really no different. But it's actually a really good question, and I highly recommend that we bring this up as a topic in further calls.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you for that. Let's see who's next. Carrie, you're up next.
Yeah. This is really interesting. One question I have, and I think it is more of a social engineering question too, is what if the domain changes hands? Or what happens then? What are your recommendations?
Okay, excellent question. So two things. One is, when looked at from a certain perspective, DID web plus hash links do two contradictory things. they reuse the existing trust relationship of the domain, and at the same time, they trivialize the role of whoever, of the server that is hosting the document, in the sense of once you lock down, once you use hash addressable links like hash links, you essentially don't care where they come from. And so at very least, you have the guarantee that when the domain changes hands, they will not be able to tamper with the contents. So at least there's that. But you're absolutely right. As soon as the domain changes hands, there is a very real change in the trust relationships that users may not be aware of. It's a great question. I don't think the technical world in general has a solution on it. The only other thing that I would add is we could explore using the certificate transparency infrastructure to detect and notify users of changes in ownership, of organization change in ownership of the domain. And that would make an excellent topic for an IAW or rebooting Web of Trust paper or any sort of academic paper in general. So great question. We don't know yet. Possibly we can reuse certificate authority to detect those changes.
Yeah, that's a great point. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Can I just
say thank you.
Can I put myself on the queue? There's a group in the W3C, also a community group called The Credible Web.
Yes, yes.
And they are talking about this. One of the topics they're talking about is this very issue. It's really worth taking a look at the work they're doing. They're just beginning work on their content model.
Fantastic.
But there's a white paper that they wrote. They're considering using verifiable credentials. It's completely undecided, but just last week they were talking about whether the domain ownership changing hands is an issue that affects credibility. So the whole concept of a reputation on a website is one of the very concepts that they're addressing. So the group started out talking about how to address the issue of fake news, but it affects so much beyond news, right? The reputation of a website and whether it is a reliable source of information, or in this case, someplace that you can rely on to convey credentials, is something that affects every piece of the web. And they are beginning to address this issue of what is a reputable website, what is a credible website, and they're beginning to build out a content model based on this work already done at the Credibility Coalition and a model called NewsQ.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I highly recommend everybody take a look at the Credible Web working group or community group and their document.
They need people with proficiency in RDF and friends if anybody wants to volunteer to help write that content model.
Excellent, excellent. So I know we're running out of time. Fia, I think you're on the queue.
That was what I was on the queue for.
Oh, that was you. Okay, okay, excellent.
And Terry, right. I wanted to come back. Did you have anything else you were wanting to say to close?
I didn't. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Well, thank you again, Dimitri, for joining. I actually have another question, but we might invite you back to talk some more about it.
All right.
So thank you so much. That was very useful. And next week actually is a U.S. holiday, and so we'll probably cancel. But we'll see you at least 2 weeks from now. And have a great week. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.